friends, and welcome to episode 64 of Did You Bring the Hummus podcast. I'm Kimberly, your host, and I'm super excited to be here with you today. Did You Bring the Hummus is a podcast to help you go vegan. Most importantly, we'll talk about how to embrace this meaningful decision with fervor and fun. Episodes post every Monday on your favorite podcast app. Before we get started, I have one very important question for you. Did you bring the hummus? Are you nervously prepping for the upcoming holidays? Are you hoping to create a vegan feast, or are you feeding a vegan guest and have no idea what to do? Need some help with veganizing a favorite animal-based recipe? Sign up for my signature class, Veganize It, the holiday edition. I'm offering two class options, Sunday, December 10th, and Thursday, December 14th at 7:30 p.m. Eastern. These are held over Zoom. Click the link in the show notes to sign up. Today, I am joined by Gareth Gaz Skurr of Big Sugary Dog. Gaz is a plant-powered creative for ethically driven brands, businesses, and personalities. His years of experience include working for the fastest growing animal rights charity on social media, leading their content production and visual design. During his time there, he assisted in catapulting their following from 140,000 to over 2 million in just 4 years. There is nothing Gaz likes better than helping people elevate their brand to reach the audience and achieve the results they deserve. He is also proud to be New Zealand's first certified vegan hospitality consultant, trained personally by the incredible Meredith Marin of Vegan Hospitality. Through this work, Gaz provides services in menu evaluation, kitchen and service training, recipe development, food photography, and education in regard to the vegan palate, as well as the requirements of vegan and plant-based diners when it comes to nutrition, variety, and value. Gaz shares his vegan journey, tips on protecting yourself from activism burnout, how he helps his clients through his unique blend of hospitality training and graphic design expertise, and of course, his favorite hummus. Hey, Gaz, thanks for joining me. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me. I've been hungry for this interview.
I love it. That will make sense throughout once we get through the episode. Well, welcome. I love to start my every episode, every interview with a really important question. Please share your vegan journey.
Oh, brilliant. Well, for me, it was a real curveball doing the whole vegan thing. I grew up with the whole, you know, catch it, kill it, cook it, eat it sort of mentality, and raised to sort of with that homesteading sort of lifestyle in mind growing up. And so that's always what I was going to do. And as a kid and a teenager, I had a couple of vegetarian friends and I'd tease them to no end. I was a meathead, you know, I was a cheeseaholic, and I used to make pasta bakes and put 500 grams of cheese, and it's half a block of cheese in the pasta bake. You couldn't really get a fork through it. It just stand in the top of it. And so it really wasn't anything on my radar whatsoever. My family, my granddad was French, and so everything was meat, wine, and cheese. Every meal, it would include that in some way. He'd pour wine in his soup with a sprinkle of cheese, you know, like it had to have that. And so, yeah, I went through life, you know, vegetarian wasn't even entertained. But it wasn't until I was living on the road with my wife and we were living in this tiny little camper van. I call it camper van. It's more like a tradesperson's van. You couldn't even stand up in it. And she started having chronic health problems when we got on the road. And so things kept on progressing and getting worse, and we're going back and forth to the doctors, and that they could never really come up with a clear sort of diagnosis of things and couldn't really get down to the bottom of it. And we're searching for everything, you know, just to see what can make a difference, because especially when you're on the road, you're going to be living this high life and exploring here in New Zealand, Aotearoa, you know, it should be a beautiful, wonderful experience everywhere you go. But we're struggling with this, and it got to a stage where my wife was looking into alternative things and like plant-based eating, and hence found veganism. And I said to her, I love you and I support you. I'll always support you, but there is no way in hell am I ever doing vegan. You know, I was the meat-eating macho man, you know, or so I thought, you know. And it just took 5 days for me. Days watching her going through, you know, changing her food, changing her diet. One thing, once again, being in a tiny little van, all this amazing, fresh looking food. All of a sudden, it wasn't beige and like brown corpse. You know, it wasn't the stuff I was eating, or like half a block of cheese. It was all these vegetables and wonderful stuff. And that really enticed me into trying to eat it anyway, because we weren't going to cook two meals in the camper van. That just not a happening thing. And she was watching What the Health on her laptop, and I was sort of sitting end to end in the van. I was busy playing a game on my laptop. I was killing things. And she had this documentary playing, and I had her earphone out just so that then, you know, if she needed to yell at me for something, I could hear her still, you know, or I'm still close enough for a slap in the van. So it's, I thought about keeping the ear out. And this sort of little factoid came up in it about the links between dairy consumption and dementia. And as I previously mentioned, my granddad was French, and the wine, the cheese, the meat in every single meal, you know, that was so much of his diet. And just at that stage, he'd got diagnosed with dementia. And for me, it was, you know, it just really hit home that I was sort of, it's that case of you're almost prematurely losing that relative when it's with dementia. You know that, you know, they might still be here, but they're not here. And, you know, fortunately, that's what got him in the end. But even in the early stage of him being diagnosed and having this come up at just the right time for me, it got the gears turning that, one second, if I can eat all this lovely, gorgeous, bright, vibrant food that my wife's making now, and it gives me a chance of avoiding that, why wouldn't I? You know, what's I'd be an idiot not to at least give it a try. Maybe it turns out to be a load of rubbish, but it's worth a try. And, you know, I don't believe it is a load of rubbish now. I think we're bang on the money with that. You know, it makes a lot of sense, but it was just worth a go. And so it really broke down those barriers for me with getting into, at first it was plant-based eating. You know, I can't say I was vegan from the get-go because I didn't understand the animal ethics of it. Mm-hmm. You know, I was happy with the food, but I hadn't quite got that grasp. But it really enticed me into it. And there was that whole aspect of masculinity then with food. And previously, you know, I'd been wearing that mask of masculinity. I'd been pretending to be more manly than I was by having the steaks and the chops and all this other rubbish just to hide my own insecurities, really. And by choosing to eat a different way with plant-based food, it was me actually making my own choice to do that. It wasn't just leading one going by society's example. I wasn't just being led to eat that stuff anymore. It was me taking control of my life. And so we'll probably end up talking about it more. I faced quite a bit of backlash, especially here in New Zealand, about being a bloke eating plants instead of dead things. Well, they're dead plants at least. But and it didn't take long for me to actually get the animal ethics. And so I do consider that I went vegan quite fast, almost, you know, it's probably about 10 days, because at the same time where we were camping was a working sheep farm. And so they had a couple of orphan lambs, and the caretaker Bevan there, he was a right character, and he came over, all right, I know a couple of soft touches when I see them. You can be the foster parents for these orphan lambs. And so we had Casper and Dudley, and we also had our dog with us on the road, and we'd go for walks, and Casper and Dudley would follow the dog. And I've got to say, they were actually better behaved than our dog Minnie. But we'd go for a walk, and they'd come along too. And it was just, you know, there was no real difference there between, you know, the sheep were smarter than our Cocker Spaniel. And we just got to know these characters. And I'd always thought I'd loved animals, you know, and I do believe that everyone can say that they love animals. It's just that there's a bit of cognitive dissonance there, you know, between what love is. But, you know, I think it is still valid, because I felt like an animal lover as a kid, despite wanting to cook it and eat it. But this was what really cemented that understanding of them as being their own individual sentient beings. And, you know, I didn't want to eat those anymore. You know, Bevan could come and wave lamb chops at us as much as he likes, and it was like, no thanks, I'll have what the lamb is having instead. I'll eat the grass. I'd rather have that, you know. So yeah, that's sort of it in a large nutshell, I'd say.
Yeah, That's a great story. And wow, yeah, so fast. Good for you.
Yeah, I tend to be, as we say over here, rip shit and bust. get straight into it. And yeah, it's either all or nothing for me. And so, yeah, we didn't do the whole cold turkey phase or anything like that. It was just a case of let's get on with it and make that change. And I think that is really important for folks if you are looking at going plant-based or transitioning into a vegan lifestyle, is just to really just knock it on the head. Don't try and phase it out. The biggest thing that helped us was changing our dietary pattern. So we started eating a lot of Indian and sort of Asian food for the first couple of weeks, because that got us out of the tendency of dumping cheese in it, because you don't mm-hmm. have a curry and dump a load of cheese in it. You don't have noodles and dump a load of cheese in it. So, mm-hmm. you know, adjusting those sort of patterns really helped. And also, you know, a lot of the Asian cuisine is just absolutely beautiful, plant filled, spicy, vibrant. It's all mm-hmm. so good. So that really helped us. And yeah, didn't need to transition too much.
Yeah, I love that too, because when we think about how addictive animal foods and cheese specifically, right, are, the idea that like, okay, I'm going to phase this out, our brains are still hooked on it, like physically, right? We know that cheese has that like casomorphine, which has the same effect on our brains that, you know, drugs do. That's why people love cheese so much. And when we keep feeding ourselves that, we're not giving ourselves a chance to let go and to just get through that like need for it and then be over it. Or you take a week off and you're like, oh, you know, I phased out cheese a little bit, but I really want cheese tonight. And so then you just start it over again. But this idea that you just kind of are like, all right, let's just do it all at once. And I think the key, and I haven't heard anyone say this before, and I love that you said that, the key is to change up your eating pattern. It's like breaking any habit, right? People who are quitting smoking, like you've got to, if you always have coffee with a cigarette, stop having coffee, you know, after lunch every day or whatever that habit is, you've got to take that anchor away. And so your anchor was, we make this food, it gets a load of cheese in it. I'm not going to make this food for a while. I'm going to make something different. And you're still nourishing yourself. It was still interesting food. It was food that you were enjoying. So then you're also not having that feeling of like, oh, I miss this other food.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Because that's a big thing for folks, is that, you know, I'm missing out now, when it's really not the case. I will say, if you are somebody who's, you know, like me, I was a full-on cheeseaholic. if you're trying to then transition into plant-based, you know, don't go buying the vegan cheeses straight off the bat as well, because they are not a one-for-one comparison. As much as out here we have the amazing Angel Food cheese, and they do brilliant vegan cheese. But if I was to go stop one day dairy, queso, morphine, addicting cheese and go to this other one, it's a completely different thing. It scratches the itch for me now, and it does a brilliant job of that. And I really enjoy it as cheese now. But going from one to one, I often hear people sort of saying, like, oh, it's just not the same. It's not the same. It's like, no, it's not supposed to be exactly the same. It's there to scratch an itch down the road, you know. That, for me, that 2 week sort of period of changing the diet up really did help, and it got me excited about food again. I'd always loved baking as a kid and doing a bit of cooking, but for most of the time I was quite a fussy eater. Whenever we went out somewhere, I would just go get a burger, you know, or ribs or a steak, you know, just I'm a man, I've got to get this sort of thing, you know, not adventurous at all, my food. And all of a sudden, by doing this sort of shift and this change, and as I say, getting into a lot of these Asian cuisines, it really invigorated my love for cooking. And especially for us in a tiny little space, there was nothing but getting involved in it. And that's evolved, you know, as we'll talk about, my career is sort of based on food these days, and it's such a fundamental part of life. And so, it's an opportunity to get excited about what nourishes you. And I think that's a beautiful thing.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. I want to go back to something else that you said about the masculinity and food. As I remember that my husband when we first, so we've been living where we are now for like 8 years. And where we are now is kind of in a farm, very farm heavy area of New Jersey. So we, and it's also very like Republican and like yay guns. And it's a weird place in New Jersey because it's very Democratic otherwise, like overall. But so we live in this area. And right before we moved, my husband had decided to try being vegetarian. So he'd been living with me for a while and was starting to learn some things, right? And he's like, okay, I'm going to be vegetarian, and was doing it for about 6 months. And then we moved here and we started to meet the neighbors, and we knew the neighbor next door, like right off the bat, was like, I'm a hunter. This is what I like. I love beer. I love this. I love that. And he felt really uncomfortable about being like, I'm a vegetarian. Because the guy's like, you guys should come over. Like, we'll grill some stuff. And I right away was like, I'm vegetarian, so you don't need to grill anything for me. And so my husband kind of was like, I don't know, if they offer me something, I may just have to eat it. And he really struggled. And he did wind up at that point going back to eating animals. And that lasted for a little while. He's vegan now. And I went vegan probably like less than a year after that. But he really had a lot of those moments. And what shifted for him is we heard Gene Bauer from Farm Sanctuary. He was at a local farm that does not raise animals near us. And he gave a talk, and he talked a lot about how the expectation is that you're a man, and being manly means that you eat dead things and you kill stuff, and like you're big and tough, and you can only be big and tough if you're eating animals. And how untrue that is, and how finding compassion and being a man means standing up and fighting for what's right. And that really started to shift things for him. And now, you know, he's good and he's vegan, and he is not ashamed ever to tell someone. But it's a process.
Yeah, it is huge. And like with that, for me, when I was growing up, I got bullied a lot. I was a very sort of emotional sort of kid. I was quite sensitive. And so I ended up adopting a lot of sort of patterns in my life, which were coping systems to deal with that. And one of them was, as I said, with masculinity. You know, I tried to be the lad's lad, you know, I tried to be real blokey bloke. And so like when the options of food came along, you know, you'd get the, what was the stereotypical man thing of, you know, oh, a steak, you know, and big hunks of meat and stuff like that, you know, because that'd make me feel stronger. But back in all the years when I was doing that, was the most times I was getting emasculated by other people. I was getting put down. I was so weak as an individual because I was scared to share who I truly was. And so when I did go vegan, I don't think my wife expected me to stick with it even when I first started, just because of, you know, it had become part of that identity that shielded me. Mm-hmm. But embracing it was that chance to, as I said earlier, I was taking control then. It was my choice. I wasn't just being led into this. And I think for me, that is a lot of masculinity, is making your own choices, defining your own path, being comfortable with who you are. And I'm still an emotional person. I'm still sensitive. And I love it. I embrace it. No, that's part of me as a man, is the fact that I can get in touch with these elements. And so I feel more masculine than I've ever been now. But I had a lot of challenges too, because where we were camped on that working sheep farm, it was in a little town called Gore in the south of New Zealand. And so that is like farmer capital down there. I'm actually surprised we didn't see flaming torches and pitchforks when we went vegan, because down there, tofu is exotic, you know, like that's the only thing you get in the supermarket. And so it was real sort of farmer country, but we got on well because we didn't take ourselves too seriously. And Bev and the caretaker, I'd always laugh with him. He'd come around on the ride on lawnmower and I'd say, oh, you're bringing us meals on wheels, mate, you know. And, you know, like just trying to relate with people, because I knew I hunted when I was a kid up in Wales. So I'd go catching rabbits on the weekend and make bunny burgers and do all those sorts of things. And so I knew how to talk about this stuff, and that really opened it up. And when my wife and I did a cookbook, a vegan cookbook in our little van, I had so many struggles. First of all, with the publisher, on the back of the book, they said that, you know, I was an omnivore, and I was sort of going along with what my wife was doing. And I never knew omnivore could be an insult. I was so offended by it, though, because it was that whole thing of, once again, I'm a man, so I must just be, you know, I must be whipped, and I must be, you know, it's just the wife who is directing everything.
Yeah.
And I managed to get them to change that. But when we went and did the publicity for it, I had to go on the local rock radio station. And so, of course, it's the manly rock radio station, and of course they're all like sponsored by KFC and meat and barbecues and all that sort of stuff. And they set me up with that in a way that they didn't tell the hosts who I was and what I was going on there to talk about, and they didn't tell me that they didn't know either. And so we just sort of plunged into this interview situation where they were on the back foot, I was on the back foot. And of course, straight away, one of them starts like digging at me. Oh, you know, I reckon it's just the wife in your ear. That's why you're doing the vegan thing. And I had to try and establish my footing there on live radio, just to sort of say that, you know, no, this is my decision. I'm actually a bloke who makes up my own mind. I live how I want to live.
Yeah.
This is my choice, you know. And so many times I get people like, yeah, no, it surely must be the wife doing that. And it's just, I find it very irritating. But, you know, it goes to show how weak I feel a lot of other men are if they feel that way. Like if it was them in their shoes, you know, they would only do it if the wife pushed them. It's sort of like, no, be yourself.
Yeah.
Like, I love animals. Why would I eat them? That's my decision. So, you know, but touching on sort of the point I started with is, you know, it really was helpful, though, being able to relate and actually not take myself too seriously, because when these confrontations came up, you know, I'd have a bit of a laugh about it and sort of make my point after we've sort of had a laugh. So we meet at a middle ground rather than just butting heads. And I could have just had a tizzy and hung up the phone with the interview or whatever. But
yep.
it turned out a really good one in the end. And I was quite happy with the result. And quite a few people phoned in. And it was a positive feedback because, you know, I said to them, you know, you each to their own and you do your own thing. But this is my choice. This is my decision. And that's who I am. So, yeah.
I think there's something, as much as I wish now or since I went vegan, that I'd been vegan my entire life, I think there's something really special that I wasn't, because I think it puts me in a position, just like you were able to relate to people who aren't there yet and have a conversation that has an opportunity to plant a seed, to open their eyes, to get them thinking about something. And, you know, some people might be able to change overnight, but most people don't change anything overnight, and they need to hear stuff over and over again. And if you can approach them in a way where they're like, this person's not a threat, they're not pushing me, they're not trying to change my mind, you make them think it's their idea, and then they're more likely to make that change.
Yeah, well, it is their idea.
And yeah,
I did a really interesting exercise at the start of last year. I, me and my wife, we joined Prem Rawat's peace education training. And so our landlady holds it down in the local hall. And so Prem Rawat's mission is all about getting people to understand that peace is within you. And so if we want to find peace in the world, then we have to find it within ourselves. And during it, we did an interesting exercise where we had to compare two groups of people. And at the time, I was working full time at Vegan FTA. And so my whole life, my whole every day was just working in activism and animal advocacy. And so, of course, the groups I picked was vegans versus non-vegans. And we had to sort of go through what like differences they had and what similarities they had. And the more I went through it, I realized that we are still the same, you know. They have compassion, but it may just be, you know, only for cats and dogs, as opposed to me. I absolutely love pigs. They are fantastic beings, not to be speciesist and pick favorites, but I do absolutely love pigs. And just so much of this, we're not different people. We're all humans. We're all the same species, and we all have that ability to find peace within ourselves, to find compassion, to find love, to find hatred even. And it all comes down to perspective. And that was a real sort of big moment for me. It was looking at it, because I'm looking at my computer monitor right now, and I can see your lovely glowing face and the front of my monitor. But someone standing on the other side would just see the black plastic case on the side of it. You know, and we can yell at each other about what I'm seeing and what they're seeing, but without knowing and without me having that perspective around the back, I couldn't tell if they're lying or if I'm lying to them or whatever's going on. And so this is what we're approaching, is that we're two sides who just don't have the full picture. We're only seeing it from one side. And so for me, advocacy now is so much about trying to understand one another, because that's what we need more in this world. We've got so much divisiveness. Mm-hmm. Like we are, you know, you've got the gun, yay guns, and all the other sort of things. We need to be able to understand each other to see where we're coming from. Then we can see where we can go to, you know, and that's how we sort of find peace through these processes. And when I say find peace, I don't mean the hippies, you know, we need to go put flowers in all their guns and all that sort of stuff. That might be wonderful too, though, but you know, we need to start understanding people more and recognizing that on any given day, we've all got our own issues. As I've previously talked about, all my masculinity issues, you know, I was dealing with that stuff. And when I was dealing with all those sort of problems and other issues I had, animals weren't even on the radar, because I couldn't even get my own shit together, let alone worry about somebody else's. And so the more we can empathize with animals, which means human and non-human, the more we can build a more compassionate world.
What a wonderful thought. When I meditate, I do a lot of loving kindness meditation. Mm-hmm. And I, now the name of it is escaping me, but there's another meditation, starts with a T. Maybe it'll come back to me.
Is it Tonglen?
Maybe. Yeah. Where you actually take
compassion to others.
Yeah. And you take in their pain and you I did this meditation where you actually imagine, you know, someone that really like riles you up or something. And you think about the pain that they're experiencing and what it must be like. And you take that from them and give them your compassion and your kindness and your love. And it's like this whole process of really starting to like feel for other people and to being able to take in that kind of, I don't know, that experience where you can see someone that really just like drives you nuts and then see them from a different angle and almost empathize or be able to feel for them. And wow, does that take away a lot of anger when you do something like that?
Yeah, there was, I believe it was through Brené Brown, I'm sure it was her. There was an exercise where there was sort of a pastoral sort of church group, and these researchers, they got the folks there to think about a friend or a loved one or an acquaintance they knew who was just, yeah, as you say, a real pain in the backside, just awful. Like somebody who you think, you know, they just lack anything, that they just waste their life, you know, just a complete waste of space, you know, someone who really angers you, and got them to do as you say, you sort of think about that, and then told them, you know, what if God came to you then and said they're trying their best, you know, and to me that was a really sort of interesting thing. For me, I'm not a believer, but you know, just that aspect of understanding that these people are doing their best, you know, every given day, they're doing all that they can. And so, yeah, having that compassion, it really is huge, because, you know, it doesn't mean letting people off doing horrible things. You know, people are always accountable for their actions. We have to hold ourselves accountable for our actions, but we've got to approach it with that compassion of, okay, that's where they're at. How can we move this forward? How can we let them see the other side of the perspective? How can we let them see the whole picture without getting into to more rows and pushing them further away? So, yeah, compassion. This is a compassion-based movement. So let's be compassionate. As Buddhists say, you know, do no harm. That goes to outside things, like to the animals, to everything in the world around us, but also means to other human beings, and especially ourselves. So often we're doing harm to ourselves. And so do no harm means to you too.
Right. You know, and I know, you know, thinking from my own perspective, talking with other vegans, sometimes it can be hard to be compassionate or very easy to be, to vilify when you think, when you start to learn, especially when you're first learning, I think you start to learn about what's really going on in the food agriculture system. And you know what people who are in that system are doing to the animals. And it's very easy to just decide these people are monsters and to not give them any compassion and to not understand how they wound up there, what they experienced, the trauma that they're experiencing every day reporting to work like that. And it's just, it's so, there's a lot of emotions, right? Yeah. There's a lot of emotions there.
I'm lucky to get the perspective I do from my wife, because she was a dairy farmer, dairy and beef farmer for 18 years. And so the experience that she had within the dairy industry just really, some of the things that happened were shocking, but it's interesting to know how much it affected her doing it. And also her ex-husband, who was often the one doing a lot of the stuff like having to kill off calves. And fortunately there's a process called inducing, which has now been banned, but you know, that would just, I won't go into it because it's just horrific, but they had to kill 20-30 calves one day, you know, and they just wouldn't die. And like that traumatized even him, this guy who I really struggle to have compassion for this bloke, but I won't go into that either. But somebody who you normally wouldn't, you know, flinch anything like that, you know, even they suffer through all these things. Yeah. And yeah, we do have to understand that it's not just people. You do get some sick people who relish this stuff, but most of them are people who've just become so desensitized because they've got to put food on the table. They've got to pay their bills. When we were living in Gore, just down the road was another town called Matoura, and they had a massive meat packing plant, and the suicide rate there was through the roof. It was just very high because the work there, the packing plant, was so depressing and horrible, but the pay was so good that people would desensitize themselves in order to do that so they can make a decent living to hopefully better their lives. And so yeah, a lot of these people, they're not monsters, they're just part of this system that finances suffering. And so it's so good to have that compassion for them. And I know it's hard. We all have that sort of angry vegan stage. My one came quite a bit later on, I must say. Like, I managed to stay pretty chill most of the way, but you can probably tell already I'm a laid back dude.
A little bit.
Maybe too much of a hippie when I was a teenager, but it's good to have anger. Anger is a healthy emotion, especially if you express it in the right way. If you don't express emotions, it becomes depression. So expression is the reverse of depression. So express what you need to. But yeah, if you focus on the anger, if you live in the anger, if you live in the hatred, that's when you burn out. And that happened to me. That happened to my the end of my work at Vegan FTA. I got to the stage where it was just burnout after burnout after burnout because I was dealing with the trauma of what happens to animals every day. And I still had the underlying trauma that I still hadn't dealt with. I felt like more of a man, but that also revealed all the other sort of flaws within myself. And so understanding trauma has been the big subject for me sort of the last sort of 4 to 6 months. And so many of us don't even realize what's going on because we blocked it. Our minds have put it out of there. I'd forgotten so much about what my father was like. And he was a nasty person. But, you know, it's taken me 28 years to sort of remember it. So that's what the brain does. And everyone's living with something. We just got to have compassion to let them open up, to let them share that. So that then they can move on to the other things, like having compassion for others.
Yeah. So your work at Vegan FTA, tell me about that.
Well, my wife and I, we were still on the road, and she's a writer by trade now. And so she started doing volunteer writing, and eventually as things started to grow, they got to a stage where they needed more video content. So I was working as a photographer and sort of a freelance video maker for travel magazines and other sort of news publications. It was great. We're out on the road, go off, go walk some waterfall, take photos, write an article about it, get paid for it.
Yeah.
It was wonderful. Apart from all the, as I say, chronic health stuff, all the other calamities around it. But yeah, I got on board and we started doing tours of some of the animal sanctuaries out here. And that was fantastic, getting to go and interact with the animals and the caretakers there and really bring it to a new audience. And also we went and did Food Innovators too. Christchurch in New Zealand, it's the largest city in the South Island. It's a fantastic place for vegans out here. And there's so many great companies like Greater Goods. They do all these vegan deli meats and stuff and absolutely perfected it. There's quite a few other great examples, and we're filming those. And it progressed that it was myself, Jackie, my wife, and the founders, Sarah and Mikey. We were just a close little team. Mikey, he had another job, so it was pretty much just the three of us. And we grew from 140,000 followers over 2 million by the time I left. And it was just a little ragtag bunch of underqualified, overachieving misfits. We didn't really know what we were doing, but we got into it. And yeah, we're able to spread the word of animal rights and really we really did get a lot of people behind the cause and help amplify voices. So a big part of my role became, especially with COVID, we couldn't drive around and tour all these sanctuaries and stuff. It was moving into inspiring activism. And we started a video podcast, which is still available on the Vegan FGA YouTube, called Activist. And so we had, I think Patrick Baboumian was our very first guest from the Game Changers. And yeah. He was just doing his Earthraiser comic at that stage. And so we got folks like him on to talk about their forms of activism. For him, you know, it was showing the plant-powered sort of athlete you can be, but also in the new light of he was making this comic book that was all about animal liberation and bringing it in a creative way. And so I absolutely loved that. And so we went on interviewing all these other people who Meredith Marin, wonderful vegan hospitality consultant, she helped to make the island of Aruba one of the best vegan hotspots in the world. Just by helping working with restaurants. And that's something I'll talk about more later. Yeah. But there's just so many different ways that people could be active. And especially during lockdown, for here in New Zealand, we're in a very hard lockdown and we locked down early and for a long time. It meant that people lost their usual forms of advocacy, which is, you know, the shouting and yelling with placards and getting out there on the street talking to people. And you just couldn't have the interaction. People lost their communities due to that. And we just wanted to show people that there's so many different ways you can be getting out there. And I love being a part of where we met, we're a vegan business tribe, where there's loads of vegan accountants, a lot of vegan creatives like myself who do graphic design, web. There's events organizers, any sort of job you can imagine. Yeah. There's becoming vegan versions of that. And that is wonderful because that is a form of advocacy. We're showing that we can build a world without the need for using animal products. And I just love being part of that flourishing community because it inspires me so much that there's so many different ways to connect with people and it's not all in your face. For me, I don't like the confrontation. I like to sort of work with someone. I like to talk to someone. I like to understand them. I like to get to a mutual point. And so, yeah, FTA really did open those gateways for me to do that. And we had a wonderful time doing that. I end up the creative director to put a title on it, and we're doing all the graphics and sort of videos. Basically anything with imagery, that was my sort of bag. And it was such a great time doing that. But it came to an end, as I say, because I was getting into burnout again and again, because I wasn't doing the right things for myself. And it is very hard as well, being a small team, especially when we expanded out to, there's now Vegan FTA, the Spanish channel, we've got a Japanese channel, the Philippines channel, wanted to do an Indian one as well. But it's sort of, yeah, it was amazing growth and an amazing team there. It's now it's like I can't remember how many. There's like 10, 11 of them there now, is fantastic. But it was a great experience. And I've still got FTA tattooed on my knuckles.
Because yes, everything do.
everything I do is for the animals. I should probably say, vegan FTA is vegan for the animals. And so, it really is part of my whole life now is doing what I do to help animals through animal advocacy. It's just in a different way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I love that because I've said this so many times. So people who are regular listeners are like, all right, Kimberly, we know this already. It's so important that we have so many different types of activists. And as far as I'm concerned, if you are living a vegan life, whether the people in your immediate family know and no one else does, or you're like me with a big mouth shouting it to the world, we're all activists. Because we're showing up differently in every action we take, especially as a vegan, because we're motivated by that compassion. There's this philosophy, there's this full life that we're living that's completely governed by this idea. And so we show up and we do things differently. And so we're all activists. And some people need to just have a really great meal, talk to a vegan and be like, I can do this, because for a lot of people, it's a lot easier to change buying a different shampoo than it is to change, never eating your favorite grandma's meal again. So if you can get them with the food, the rest of it's usually a lot easier. But then there's also people who need to see the graphic imagery. They've got to know what's happening. And there's some of us like me who I don't want to be the person to show you that. So there's a different activist that is for that person to get them to see things differently. My people don't want to see that stuff. They want to hear the truth, but they don't need to have the photos in their face. And I love that there are all these different ways that we're all showing up and in places that people don't expect.
Yeah.
Like, for example, you're doing the vegan hospitality, and congratulations on being the first certified vegan hospitality consultant in New Zealand. But you also have your graphic design. And so let's talk about Big Sugary Dogue and what that means and what you're doing with it.
Well, thank you so much. And before I jump into that, I do want to say as well, with just being vegan and that being an activist, for me, when we had the two orphan lambs, we'd often post the photos on Facebook and stuff like that. We were just doing our own thing. We weren't loud and proud about it. But my mum would see the lambs and she'd go, mint sauce, and like little comments like that. But she's gone vegan now. And I never bothered trying to push her. And I was never like, oh, no, you should go vegan. You should do that. You need to see the research on this. I just did my own thing. And, whenever she do that, I just do the thumbs up, okay, yep, whatever, mom, love you too, you just do your thing. And just having her see how much it transformed my life, without having to spout it, without having to shout it, mm-hmm. it got her to start analyzing what it was I was doing, and the gears start turning for her. And now mm-hmm. she's vegan too, and that's wonderful. It annoys the hell that's out awesome. My brother, also wonderful. I always thought I was the black sheep in the family, but I've converted mum now as well. So I think that's good. So it really does make a difference, just leading by example. When I had the opportunity to talk to Dr. Michael Clapper, absolutely lovely person. He gave the same thing, you need to lead by example. And so, that really is good. But onto Big Sugary Dogue. this is a sort of, it's been a dream really to follow my creativity and really be able to express myself fully. Because when you're working with a very large organization, there are certain sort of tactics and methods you have to do to make sure things perform and they do well. And a lot of the more artistic sort of content and stuff like that would often be like, we love it, it's great, but it doesn't perform. And so for me, with my design work and stuff like that, I want to make stuff that is beautiful. I'm not so worried about the algorithm. I'll mm-hmm. make it do well. But my focus is on the artistic integrity and creativity. And so what I do is I combine my vegan hospitality training, which I mentioned before, Meredith Marine, she does a wonderful course. And I took that back in 2021. Mm-hmm. and finally get to use the skills now. But through Vegan Hospitality Consulting, we do high impact consulting where we go to cafes, restaurants, hotels, any hospitality industry. And we get, it doesn't matter if they're plant-based, that's great, but it's more the ones who are plant curious, somebody who wants to expand their customer base, somebody who wants to understand this emerging vegan market. Here in New Zealand, 6 to 10% of the population identify as vegetarian or vegan. And apparently we're the fourth on one of the vegan sort of best places to be vegan.
Cool.
I struggle with that sometimes. I don't know if that's quite right, but maybe I'm just not seeing it. I meet a lot more stubborn farmers. But, you know, there's a massive potential for businesses to not only future-proof themselves, they can really be engaged with a whole new loyal customer base. Because I think we know when we find a good vegan option, we go back again and again. And again.
We bring all our friends.
We are the veto vote, you know, like we often get that sort of that choice of where the party goes. And so we help with doing the menus, just even small changes can make vegan options happen. We also help with how they can source products so they can actually, they know what they're looking for. Because when you first go vegan, it's a bit of a minefield trying to find things without the hidden milk in it or egg or all the other stuff. So we help with that. And also we help with launching it and teaching the staff as well what it means for a customer to be vegan. So, you know, you can have plant-based options, but if the staff don't know what a vegan is, you know, they're probably going to be like, oh, well, we added some yogurt for you just to be friendly. And it's like, no, that's not good. That's not good. So I was actually thinking before this, you know, I'd love to know what one of your worst vegan sort of meals has been when you've gone out, because I know I've got a few doozies, but like, have you been out and just had served full price, an absolute shocker? Is there anything that comes to mind for you?
I can't believe it. I can't think of one in particular. You tell me yours and maybe it'll trigger something for me.
Well, for us, whilst we were touring about, we went and it was like a green risotto type thing. And so they're saying that we can veganize this. And originally it's like this chicken and pea risotto. And so that they said, like, this is our vegan option as well. We take out the chicken. You have to take out the stock that it was cooked in. There was half a dozen other ingredients that were taken out. And so we end up with like just this bowl of green rice that was just like peas and rice, and then charged like it's New Zealand dollars, so it's about $30, so that'll be about $50, almost $60. And it was just like, yeah, that's our vegan option, you know. And it's just like taking out everything that made that dish what it was, but still called it a vegan option. And so that's just one of many terrible terrible things out there. And I appreciate them trying to add something. But I was talking to my wife about this earlier. It's kind of like when the kid comes home from kindergarten, they've got their finger painting and you got, yes, that's lovely, dear. I'll put it on the fridge and it'll stay there for a week.
Yep.
But you're not going to go take that to, you know, the Tate Modern Art Gallery. Well, maybe you could, but they accept all sorts these days. But, you know, you're not going to go and charge someone full price then for your kindergarten kid's finger paint, you know, like not again and again and again. A week, that's a nice little novelty. But there's so many places that they just don't put in the effort to understanding the audience. They're just looking at us as a problem. And I'm here to solve that problem for them. I'm there to reason with them, be like, look, I'm a human being. I'm a bloke. I like a big meal. I like one that satisfies me through, you know, the protein, the fat, the carbs and fat. Oh, yes. Yes, please. Yeah. He says, but you know, there's so much more. Vegans deserve as much of a dining experience as anybody else.
Absolutely.
If you did the same with a meat dish, you know, if you put a meat patty between two buns and serve that as your burger, you're going to get complaints. People are going to stop coming to you. But that's no problem, because that's you know, that's meat eaters. But when a vegan complains about the same equivalent, you know, they see it as a much bigger problem. So my job is to find that compassionate middle ground, to talk to these people, to help them, to really help them expand their business, get more money in through the door, and enjoy this plant cuisine. And hopefully those little tendrils creep out and plant a little seed too, that maybe we can make more of the menu vegan. Maybe we could be even more inclusive. And that's what I love about it. It's sneaky. It's like kind of guerrilla activism, I feel, you know, guerrilla with an O. and so, yeah, that's a primary focus of Big Sugary Dog is vegan hospitality consulting. And then with the graphic design too, that just allows the creativity. And so now when I'm speaking about these things, especially through my social media channels, I love doing illustration and I love setting things out so that they look beautiful. Here's your new menu for your restaurant. It looks stunning as well. And you need a new logo for it, or you need a new website for it. Hey, you know, we can get this all in one and make it so that you're not just a place that serves well, you're also a brand that stands out against the crowd. You're someone who's really going to cement yourself in their minds, because I've had so many amazing meals out and about, but quite often I'll remember the meal, but not the place, because I don't remember the brand. You know, there wasn't much to the brand. It was this, they had this sort of musty air around the place and then a few tables and chairs. I think they had a logo. I can't quite remember. I think it's just that name on the side of the building. Yeah, that's the one, you know. I want someone to be like, oh no, we went to Big Sugary Dogs and we had the most wonderful donuts, you know, them melt in your mouth. But that little dog mascot, oh, I love it, you know. I want their customers to have that experience with their restaurants and stuff. And so I think it's a really good fit. It's been a lot of hard work trying to bring them together, because for folks who will listen to this, and anyone who checks out my about page will find out that I've done a hundred different things and different avenues, and it's been a big, long and winding road. But at the end of the day, it all comes back to food for me. Like, there's been a driving force. And so, if I can eat food and doodle, I'm quite happy.
I'm that happy. That sounds day. Like quite a life. Yeah. That is wonderful. I love it. I love it so much. You know, I've got one more question, but before I get there, I want to go back and I want to talk about Ken the Camper, which is where all this was happening. Why was his name Ken? And just a little bit more about, like, what is that like living in such a small space? With obviously a person you love very much, but the whole thing, and then you had a dog with you too. Yeah.
We had an obese Cocker Spaniel with us too. And so, it was absolutely fantastic. I must say, I'm so glad we did it when we did, because it was sort of when COVID hit that we had to stop doing that type of lifestyle, because me and my wife were both originally British, and so we have this European accent. And so Europeans traveling around in a little van, everyone's like, when that happened, everyone's like, no, get away from here. You're plague bringers. And we're like, no, we've been here like 20 years, so you don't have to worry about us. We've been neutered and tested and all the other stuff. So, but it's fantastic. And Ken came from his number plate. So he was Ken 652. And, It just seemed appropriate. So many motorhomers, they will name their van, their bus, their caravan. And so Ken was already on the plate there. So it was like, right, we'll slap that on the windscreen. And yeah, it's a, for people who know cars, I know they have four wheels. That's about my knowledge, but it's a Mazda Bongo Brawny. So it's a slightly longer wheelbase, but I think it's like 1.8 meters. Very small van. We had this little wooden kitchen sort of built into it. And yeah, it was real compact, it was snug, but you learn to adapt to these sort of things. We never slept better than we did in the camper van, because it was sort of like sardines in a tin, not very vegan expression, but you know, you're just packed in there and you're cozy, you're comfy, and everything's within arm's reach and stuff. It made going for a wee in the night a bit interesting. We had a curtain between us, but that did the job. You know, you get even closer as a couple when you've got to do those sort of things. But it was a magical time, because we got to see so much of the country. And where we'd been previously, we were living in a beach town called Phang Mai Tha. We sold up our two-bedroom house to sort of, we didn't know where we needed to get out of there, and we didn't know where we wanted to be. So we figured if we got a van, we could just travel around, figure out where it is that we truly want to settle and settle there. But we just kept going and going and going. And there's always another road to go down. And we met so many wonderful people. We had friends who've been on the road almost 60 years in their bus. Wow. And they just kept going. They're always like, well, there's somewhere else we haven't been to yet. We haven't ticked off that road yet. And there's just so many great characters, because when you find people like that, they've abandoned that sort of rat race, a lot of them. They've got away from the usual confines of society. And for me, I've always been somebody who likes to go a bit against the grain, you know. If there's a way to be different, I'll find it a lot of the time. And so it really just allowed myself to flourish. And I know for my wife too, it really did bring us out of ourselves and allow us to start finding who we really were, or like in my case, who I'd been covering up for so many years, and what I'd been sort of faking, really. Mm-hmm. And yeah, it was a magical experience. And we still, now we're in a tiny little house. It's a place that there was always advertisers only being suitable for one person. But for us, we're like, this is a mansion compared to our van, you know, this is huge. At least now we have a door between the toilet and stuff, so that's a huge improvement.
But it's
really what you get used to, and I really do encourage people to try living tiny. It takes a bit of adjustment, you know. We found for us as a couple, we've really got to have things out in the open. You know, you can't harbor onto things, because I find that's a problem. For there was one couple, they turned up at the campground, they had this huge long RV thing and it had multiple rooms and stuff. And they were always fighting, and they could fight because they had a door to slam between them. You know, one could storm off to the other end. It was no problem. Yeah. Whereas for us, if there was a fight going on, not that we didn't get any fights, because things couldn't progress to that stage. I did ban Jackie from the kitchen at one stage because she kept getting so frustrated with the small space. And like, especially I would chop my vegetables on a chopping board on top of a little heater in the middle of the thing, and it was very rickety, and so she would drop stuff and then start slamming pots and pans. And I got to say, I was just like, I cannot deal with that in the van. I'm going to do all the cooking, don't you worry, you just go sit back there and he'll be all right. But no, really, I do encourage people to try out something, like even just go for a, you know, rent a camper and go for a couple of weeks somewhere with your partner or your friends. And yeah, it's going to be stinky sometimes, you know, in a small space. Yeah, you're going to get grotty sometimes. It's going to be an adventure, and that's what life should be. It should be an adventure, not just some clean slate, you know, all the time. So, it's good. Get some dirt under the fingernails.
Yeah.
Although I must say, we weren't feral all the time. We were clean on the road too. You know, there are things like showers, but no, it's just getting down and dirty in life itself and the experiences.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I don't want to pique too much interest because the cookbook is no longer in production, but while living in this tiny camper van, you guys also wrote a vegan cookbook.
Yeah. As you can probably tell by now, folks, we are absolutely bonkers. So yeah, my wife, she ends up having to have major surgery, because going plant-based really improved her lifestyle. She managed to cut down almost all of her medication, but there's still problems going on, and she had to have major surgery. And so she was laid up in bed, there's over 4 months. And so that was still living in the camper van. And we sort of got to the stage where we realized we have to do something. Because I was working as the custodian, so we could live there for free at the sort of campground. So I was scrubbing toilets just to make sure that, you know, we could stay there and we had enough. And, you know, Jackie was like, we got to do something, you know, we got to try and do something to make our break. And so she wrote a travel book first, and we put it to a publisher, and they wanted a 2-book deal because, of course, plant-based and veganism, I think this was around 2017-ish, maybe slightly before that. I'm not good with dates and years. All my history classes went to pot. But yeah, so they wanted to do a 2-book deal with us because plant-based was on a rise, and we had started doing a vegan sort of cooking page called Camper Van Kitchen. And it amassed quite a big sort of following for the time there. And I think it's still got about 6,000 sort of followers on it. And we did a free little ebook at one stage, which had thousands of downloads. And it was just fantastic. It was just us sharing, you know, what we're cooking today. We did a separate page not to bother all our family and relatives. We're like, if people want to check it out, they can come check it out. And it was just meals we're cooking in really tiny confined spaces, like the bad people we were. And yeah, the publisher, they're like, well, we want to get more sort of plant-based sort of cookbooks going. So, you know, let's give it a go. The problem was they needed me though to do all the food photography. And of course, I'd be doing all the cooking and the styling, which people don't tell you. There's a lot that goes into styling the food all these shoots and the cookbooks and stuff. And so we end up doing Easy and Delicious Everyday Vegan. I've got to remember the rest of the tagline. Vegan recipes for busy people, he says, looking back at his bookcase. And so, yeah, that was 80 recipes, and we developed them all whilst we were on the road. And in order to photograph them and do all the photography and the cooking too, we ended up hijacking people's kitchens. And we did that through house sitting and pet sitting. And that was a real adventure. I think it was about six different houses we house sat at, and one would be for a couple of weeks, one would be like for a month. And sometimes it was with animals. There's a few of them. One in particular, Reggie, he was a terror. he broke me. I had a phobia of dogs when I was a kid, after a few bad experiences, and I'd got over that. But Reggie almost broke me again. But we were busy trying to do this cookbook, and we'd have to go take him for a walk for at least an hour and a half before we could actually start doing any cooking, because he would be sort of bothering us. But it was a case of going through all their pantries and everything like that, finding all the fine china and trying to do the food photography there in the living room. And then what we didn't have, we'd go to a charity shop and pick up plates and bowls. And I've got into a thing now. We go to the charity shops and I'm like, ooh, cutlery, you know? I never thought I'd be, ooh, that's some nice crockery. That'd be good for a cookbook, you know? And it was really lovely just to be able to do that and to, use these people's homes, of course, with their permission too, whilst we're house-sitting for them, and bring together this book that was just really ragtag. And, it was a magical sort of process. And I'm really proud of what came out of it. And, unfortunately, it's not in production anymore. Maybe one day we'll get the rights back to it and self-publish it. Mm-hmm. It was a really cool thing to do. And I never thought I'd be able to do it, because I did landscapes, I did sanctuaries, I did sort of that sort of photography and video work. I'd never done food, and I had to just teach myself and figure out the food styling. And I did have a bit of help from one of the stylists for Gourmet magazine out here. They were meant to be the advisor, although I will say I didn't get too much advice from them, so it was usually just a thumbs up and that was it. And it was a crazy process, and unfortunately we didn't make our fortune from it. That's the way of books really these days. You know, people think I'll write a book and make millions of dollars. It's like, no. That's not the case for New Zealand authors anyway. But it was an amazing experience, and it's a great resource to have now, especially being a vegan hospitality consultant, to say, look, hey, I've done this, you know. I've done the whole cookbook thing, and I did that, you know, in a meter square kitchen for most of it. That's where all the development came from. And you can make this food really simple. What we were buying was just stuff you can get at every supermarket, because we're traveling up the country. It's not like we could go to a market every week. We knew where the best produce was. It was like, okay, what's available at the supermarket? What's cheap, because we're paying for it ourselves. There's no advance. There's nothing like that. It's all the shit off our own back. And I think it came out wonderfully. And so I'm really proud of what came out of it. And now I'm just happy to be working in this food field again. And much like when I was doing the cookbook, hopefully eating a lot too.
Yeah, that's got to be part of it, to kind of work that in. So, Gaz, my final question. Tell me about your favorite hummus, or your favorite way to eat hummus.
Oh. Well, I've got to say, I'm someone who's a bit of a spice fan. And so out here, they did it was just kind of a plain sort of hummus. It was by a company, Obella. I don't think they do it anymore, but they had this like jalapeno sort of dressing in the middle of it, and like little chunks of jalapenos, and or jalapenos, as I like to joke around calling them. But so jalapenos in it, and like that is absolutely beautiful. But like for me, the best way to have it is with like sort of new potatoes, like just boiled or sort of steamed, and then dunking potatoes in hummus, or even like roast potatoes too. Potatoes, even without the hummus, but like just potatoes with it. That's my perfect way to eat it, and I need more of it. I need to be making my own. We did a hummus recipe in the book, a garlic free one, but I need to start cracking that out again. So yeah, I can add my own jalapenos to it, and we'll be away laughing. So
oh, that's good. I love a nice spicy hummus too. Good stuff. Well, Gaz, thank you so much. This conversation has been so much fun and super interesting. Thank you for sharing your stories and what you do and how you do it, and just this spreading compassion and your creativity around the world. I love it so much. Thank you.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. Yeah, it's been an absolute blast doing this. It's been a while since I've done anything like this, and it's just such a lovely sort of flow here. And yeah, I love the two question approach, especially hummus with potatoes. But it's been a grand old time, and so I hope I've been engaging for you listeners out there. And you come check out Big Sugary Dog.
The link will be in the show notes.
Fantastic. Well, I hope to connect with some of you, because if there's anything you ever want to know, reach out to me, because as I say, I've done a wild and varied lot, and so I've got a bit of insight on quite a few things, so I'm always happy to share. I'm a chatty person, as you may have found out. So thank you so much for having me on the podcast.
Yeah, thank you. Welcome back. Are you looking up tiny homes right now? Maybe a van? I did the same thing. One of the points that really stuck with me was Gaz's story about his mom, who is now vegan. This story is proof that people are watching, and that you don't need to push veganism or even actively encourage someone to help them change their life. To connect with Gaz, visit his website, bigsugarydog.com. Find him on Instagram at bigsugarydog and on LinkedIn as well. You'll find the links in the show notes. I hope you found this episode helpful and inspiring. Please subscribe to the podcast so you never miss an episode. And if you're loving it, please give Did You Bring the Hummus a 5-star rating and leave a review. It's an easy way to keep supporting the show. Be sure to share these episodes with your friends. If you're finding something good here, they will too. If you're a vegan or know a vegan who would be a great fit for the podcast, follow the Be a Guest link in the show notes. Fill out the quiz, and I'll be in touch. Don't forget to sign up for my mailing list and get a PDF of 3 amazing vegan recipes. Follow me on Facebook and Instagram at Did You Bring the Hummus, and visit my website, didyoubringthehummus.com, for more information about me, updates on what I'm working on, new podcast episodes, and all things vegan. Finally, I would love to hear from you. What do you need help with? Is there a topic you want to hear covered on a future episode? DM me on Instagram or send me an email, didyoubringthehummus@gmail.com. Thanks for listening.